The Sunstone Foundation presents Getting in the Last Word, the Book of Job as a Grief Ritual, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Getting in the Last Word, the Book of Job as a Grief Ritual. I think you'll find some unique ideas presented here this morning. Our session will proceed as follows. Becky Cornwall will take 25 minutes to present her paper, and then we'll enjoy comments from Robert Arway for about 20 minutes, and that should leave us 10 or 15 minutes at the end for audience participation. Since we have a manageable group here, and our speakers are rather accomplished, I think, let's try to keep this informal, and if you have comments or would like some clarifications as we go along, please feel free. We'll break with tradition a little and go ahead and raise your comment during the presentations if you'd like. Now, let's get to the introductions. Our commenter, Robert Arway, is director of the Weber State College Honors Program. He has a rather interesting past. He has theological training, a PhD in philosophy from a Belgian university, and he also spent 7 months at a Jung Institute in Zurich. Becky Cornwall instructs American History and English at the Utah Technical College. She is also the office manager for the Sunstone Foundation. You can read her short stories, poetry, and reviews in Mormon and regional journals, including BYU Studies, Exponent 2, Utah Holiday, Sunstone, Dialogue, and the Deseret News. And if you have any questions or doubt about her credentials at this point, let me say she is the mother of two teenage sons, which more than qualifies her for her paper today, Getting in the Last Word, the Book of Job as a Grief Ritual.
And that's the truth. I'm very happy to see friends here, Harriet and Leonard Arrington and all my friends, and it's nice to be with you. And my parents will be here in a few minutes, and I'm going to reward them by having them read in a little while, if we have time at the end. The rest of you, I assume, are here because you're suffering, or you have suffered, or you intend to suffer sometime soon. And that, if you stay for this paper, that may be sooner than you realize. Okay. One of the great appeals of the Book of Job is that it readily assumes local color. For instance, it could just as easily have taken place in Utah as the land of Uz. Don't you agree? Can you picture a venerable stake president from Riverton sitting under his venerable cottonwoods, surrounded by his leathery brother-in-laws, maybe brothers-in-law from maybe Logan, Price, and Vernal? They are mostly men of few words, but they're willing to share their sometimes salty realism that they've learned from 50 years of ranching or farming or administrating. And this is mixed with some stubborn idealism and commitment that they've learned from their pioneer fathers. Maybe they don't live on the Silk Route. Maybe they're not as cosmopolitan as Eliphaz or Bildad, but their names are just as quaint, Lorenzo, Pratt, and Heber. I can just as easily apply Job to myself, especially when I'm in trouble. No matter how murky its depths or musty the ancient papyri from which it comes to us, many of the passages are as timely as if they were just spoken. And when we need the book, it is accessible. But when I'm not in trouble, that's when Job begins to baffle me. Is the prologue a vision? I start to wonder in the middle of the night, who is the narrator? What are his credentials as observer and interpreter of both divine and terrestrial events? Who was Job? Is this a work of the imagination, of biography, of allegory, or some combination of these? Is it inspired? And if so, exactly what is it revealing to us? The traditional assessments of Job fail to satisfy me. It is usually seen as wisdom literature, similar to Psalms and Proverbs, except that it deals with a specific problem, the intellectual problem of human suffering, and why God permits it. But while certain passages, such as the wisdom chapter, are so objectively intellectual as to fit this category, Job is not an intellectual work. Claude Westerman, who is my favorite commentator at the moment, calls it primarily a lament, an emotional reaction to pain and suffering, and intellectualizing alone will not probe the book. This is what he says. What one happens to think about suffering is insignificant in the face of its reality. One has to admit that thoughts about suffering arise for the most part down in the actual arena of suffering and not up in the grandstand. Down in the arena there is real suffering. There may be lamenting and crying. Perhaps with a summoning of all one's strength, there is also silence. And in spite of everything, God might even be praised. But there is no abstract reflection about suffering. Down in the arena of suffering, life is not a problem, but reality. And it is with the reality of suffering that the book of Job deals. The book setting is in the arena, not in the grandstand. And that's been my biggest problem with most of the criticisms. Another traditional approach is to treat Job as a personal drama or a history, a personal history dramatized. Westerman agrees with this in part by recognizing Job as a real person, even if not historically identifiable. And he sees the book's theme as primarily a lament. But the personal voice is only one aspect of Job. There is too much of the non-spontaneous, symbolic, carefully wrought literary technique in Job for it to be seen as an individualistic, realistic 20th century drama. Is it moral drama instead, a morality play whose protagonists and antagonists represent general characters and ideas? Or is it disputational literature with its court-like setting, independent argument in each speech, and familiar Old Testament motifs such as the fate of the ungodly? Yet all of these aspects present the friends as purely antagonistic, when, as you read the book, occasionally they offer genuine consolation and they use some of Job's own persuasions. A disputational approach undervalues the beauties and the insights which lurk in those speeches. And since these speeches comprise the bulk of the poetic body, this slights almost the entire poetic section of Job. So to read Job as a good guy versus the bad guys, one must ignore the epilogue in which Job and the friends are equally chastised and the friends are quickly forgiven. Furthermore, a morality play has dramatic movement which is lacking in Job. True, the cycles of debate intensify, the Lord's appearance is a climax, and the epilogue smacks of denouement. But the poem is then a contradiction. Not only does the reality of Job's behavior in the poem reverse his superhuman silence in the prologue, but the poetic action has little resemblance to dramatic buildup. It is so slow and intense as to startle a reader after the swift movement of the prose opening. This prose framework has inspired another view of Job, which is that of myth. This is a tempting interpretation because you can't deny that Job comes across as a moral Hercules in the prologue. And myth need not be untrue just because it's a legendary story without determinable basis of fact, usually about some superhuman figure or event, and usually too concerned with deities and the creation of man and the world. But while chapters 1, 2, and 42 are mythical in flavor, chapters 3 through 41 have an entirely different human focus. Thus, this mythical interpretation is also less than satisfying, and none of the critical views explain the meaning of the book or explain it, period. Westerman's structural study of Job as literature helps, but it gets bogged down in the very intellectualism which he dislikes. It occurs to me that an approach which does greater justice to more of the seemingly disparate elements of this work is to read it as a grief ritual, a catharsis for the mourner. Then all the parts, prose and poetry, disputation and consolation, wisdom and lament, work together and make sense. But what do I mean by a grief ritual? And if we were to construct one, what would it contain? The first requirement would be that it would appeal to the deeper levels of human thought and feeling, unconscious as well as conscious responses. At first glance, does Job communicate in symbols of the unconscious? Notice the many references to dreams by Job and his friends. Eliphaz has visions, or at least a vision, which I'll read to you. Now a thing was secretly brought to me. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth on men, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, "Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his Maker?" Job also suffers nightmares, as he mentions in 6:4 and 7:14, and of course at times he considers the whole experience one long nightmare. Some would add that any artistic work is primarily an expression of the subconscious and appeals primarily to the same. At second glance, does Job facilitate the expression of emotional depths? It does in several ways. Through the formal literary quality of Job's speeches rings a very personal voice, which is seen best in such passages as chapter 10, verses 15 and 16. I am full of confusion, therefore see thou mine affliction, for it increaseth. And the sarcastic 12 and 2, but no doubt ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. Westerman aptly describes the essence of Job as a cry of pain, a cry that has become an utterance. Sometimes the cry goes beyond utterance with intellectual retort and emotional distance, suggesting that the author is reconciled enough to his personal losses to speak to others' experience. Note in chapter 21 the poignant directness and self-revelation of the salutation, followed by an array of images that take this speech beyond the narrow and the private. It is consciously universal and universally evocative. But a more powerful invocation of feeling is the debate itself. It provides an excuse and a setting for Job to defend himself, as he desperately must do. He should feel no reluctance in doing this, in spite of the friend's distaste for his complaints, because every character in the book is unabashedly vocal. There are the friends, who presumably represent Satan as well as themselves, although they claim to speak from the irrepressible spirit of God. There is Job, who gets in the last word, until Elihu comes along with the final last word. Elihu is then upstaged by the Lord, whose word would be ultimate, but for the narrator, who can't resist tacking on an epilogue. Later, Robert Frost writes an epilogue to the epilogue, and don't forget the critics, of whom Westerman makes the most sense in saying, the lament is the first and last word in Job. Archibald MacLeish in 1956 wrote a play, an update of it, called J.B., and even the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein has a new book entitled Job, which I haven't read yet, and then there's this paper. This plethora of last words is typical of Job. Nobody holds back, not even God. Eliphaz begins courteously, if we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But then he quickly gets to the point. Who can withhold himself from speaking? Elihu boasts, behold, my belly is as wine which hath no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles. I will speak that I may be refreshed. And amazingly, no one shuts him up. Not even Satan is barred from approaching the heavenly councils. This is not a forum for the retiring or the easily offended. In such a family circle, repression of feeling is highly unlikely. As a precedent for expression, an inducer, a cathartic, Job is inspired. Another function of a grief ritual would be to recognize the sufferer's instinctive demand for meaning and not repress it. Frost apparently found Job deficient in this regard, for his old man in a mask of reason wonders this, Lord, we showed them what? The audience has all gone home to bed, the play's played out, it seems as if now, after all these years, you might indulge me. Why did you hurt me so? Actually, Job's book thoroughly explores this instinct, even if mostly from the friend's perspective and not an immediately comforting one to Job. At least they share his need for reasons. Related to this is the need for assistance in the struggle with guilt. Show me my guilt and I will repent, pleads Job. J.B. cries, I have no choice but to be guilty. Perhaps this need is rooted in the wish to have control over events, to be able to repent and make the misery go away. Or perhaps it is just indigenous to man to assume that if bad things happen to him, he must be bad. Here, the friends, as personifications of Job's own anxieties, do him a service by assuming that he's guilty. They search him for it and inspire his self-search, which culminates in the eloquent litany of possible sins of chapter 31. Despite their gloomy assessment of the nature of God's involvement in his life, they never deny God's involvement. Contrast this to the psychiatrist comforter in J.B., who considers guilt a psychophenomenal situation, a mere illusion, or the philosopher who pontificates on how all men are guilty, always. They don't sound much like comforters to me, says Zeus truthfully. It is not much consolation to the modern reader to discover that Job is pretty much guilt-free. Most of us can find ways in which we invite many of our troubles, whereas God himself found little in Job to rebuke. As superhuman, perhaps he was a type of Christ. He had to be for the sake of the book's proposition, which is that there is no answer to suffering. And guilt eventually stands beside the point as Job leaves off arguing his innocence, and God avoids the issue except to chastise him for whining about justice. But guilt steps beside the point only after playing a central role through the entire poetic section. Admission of guilt, that dirty thumb our generation sucks at, says Satan and JB, is fortunately acceptable in contemporary society, but some needs just as deep-seated are not discussed in polite society. Yet an effective grief ritual will allow expression of these as well. The most obvious is the death wish, which is only slightly less noticeable in Job than the preoccupation with guilt. What could be more direct than this passage? And I'm reading from the New English Version this time because the King James is slightly obscure here. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that he would be pleased to crush me, to snatch me away with his hand and cut me off. For that would bring me relief, and in the face of unsparing anguish I would leap for joy. Have I the strength to wait? And then there are other references to this in chapters 10, 3, and 7. If you think such an admission would be tolerated in Mormon society, try one at Relief Society next time or in a private conversation with the average Mormon bishop. What redeems the unspeakable in Job is that it is spoken in the context of faith. Job may wish for death, but he leaves its prerogative to God. Nor would the contemporary faithful be receptive to another unspeakable, anger at God. The friends could not stomach Job's feelings of betrayal, nor his unblanching resentment at the heavens for his condition. His complaints irked them and made them itch. Believers don't want to be angry at God. They want to feel unwavering hope and serenity. Besides, it's almost as discomforting to hear about another's suffering as it is to suffer, and so persons venting related feelings will never be gladly heard. All the more reason in 1985 to read Job. It's one of the few sources of legitimate relief. This leads to another requirement of a grief ritual. It must vent the sufferer's frustration with society. What wonder if my words are wild, Job asks, as he learns that honest expression of feeling is not tolerated. He rightly begins to perceive himself as at least temporarily out of sync with his own culture. His instinct is to justify himself, but he soon learns that arguing is futile. Here, Job's drama is that of any soul who yearns for justification or aspires to communicate with the Almighty. The difference for him is that he gets his wish. His debate becomes the ultimate argument when God steps in himself and takes the case and, of course, wins it. But what vicarious relief for the reader. We've described so far a ritual that speaks to the inner man. It releases instinct of feeling, deals with the question of meaning, facilitates the resolution of guilt, and recognizes unacceptable wishes. But man is a social creature, and Job must deal with that aspect of reality as well to qualify as a grief ritual. Ritual is defined, after all, as established codes of behavior regulating social and religious conduct. How much of the ritualistic does one find in Job? At times there are only hints of it, such as in the prologue, where the sons of God twice present themselves before him. The wording suggests an ancient custom so entrenched that Satan himself neither declines nor is restrained from participating. In the poetic section, there's ritual and the elaborate delicacy and imagery in references to deity. In Job's psalm-like petitions to God, there is literary tradition, but religious as well. More obviously ritualistic is the friend's behavior when they learn of Job's misfortune. They rendezvous at his tent, rend their clothing, smear their faces with ashes, and sit in silence for 3 days. How is this ritual comforting? If nothing else, it leaves Job not alone. Even if after 3 days they get up and leave, he will still be better off than many of his modern counterparts who have no ear beyond that of a paid counselor. And even after the silence deteriorates into debate, elements of ritual check its accusing tone. Note that each speech begins with a polite personal address. The repartee is generally reserved and formal. The passion is controlled. Despite fighting words, no fights ensue. The debaters have the personalities of litigation lawyers, whom I'm told have discussions over lunch, which would be thought by normal people to be declarations of war. After Bildad's accusation in chapter 18, why doesn't Job punch him in the nose? And if he's too much of a gentleman to do this, why doesn't he at least walk off? Because Bildad's speech is expected. It is according to custom. Thus, the debate, despite Job's frequent and spirited response to it, is overall a consoling situation. Job has associates in his sorrow. These associates offer at least some consolation, as in chapter 11. Their sometimes strong words probe Job into defending himself, thereby venting his grief. Job refers to this situation as the argument, as though it were an ordinance, and perhaps it is. Perhaps these friends, not having the wisdom themselves to know what to do, are obeying a custom instituted for the mourner alone. Not only the situation, but the argument itself is ritualistic, which may explain Zophar's speech and many other passages in which the friends refute Job with arguments completely out of context with his current emotion and statements. If the friends are following a script, their words may well contain some truth as well as obvious cathartic falsehood. That's what we find in 4 and 5, 4 verses 12 through 21, 8, 20 through 2, 5, 8 through 27, chapter 5, in which Bildad continues in Job's strain, and most dramatically, Elihu's speech, in which he explains suffering as God's method of chastening or teaching man. This interpretation of the debate makes much more sense than making antagonism the central issue of Job. Perhaps we moderns are still steeped in the tradition of the rugged individualist, the straight-visioned newspaper heroes of our American novels of several decades ago, to readily perceive Job from a Middle East perspective in which Job's chief conflict is with himself. The childhood sing-song, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me," is not current any longer. And only after years of revisionism are psychologists teaching that while a man cannot always control his circumstances, he can control his responses to those circumstances. In other words, Job's friends could not hurt him with their accusations. They only voiced his own secret, conflicting beliefs. If we view Job's irritation as arising from his own suspicions that they are right, then his anger with the friends becomes a peripheral response only, and the interpersonal conflict retreats to the background. The friends come off a little better and probably closer to an ancient reader's view of them, and the modern reader is inclined to give their speeches greater attention. Thus, the ritual serves to resolve the individual's temporary conflict with society and leave him to his real losses. These characteristics of Job are its substance as a grief ritual. It touches the emotional depths of the reader, and it touches him where he stands in society. There is a third requirement of a grief ritual, which has to do with technique rather than substance, but which is just as pertinent, and that's literary merit. Literature is art, and thus has a form, and form is ritual. We might consider Job in overview. It is framed by a prose introduction and conclusion, which are so tied to the meaning of the story as to be inseparable. The framework has the quality of myth. It meets the definition of myth offered earlier, and the prose is condensed like a myth with considerable power packed into its few words and pithy repetitions. Consider these sayings, which are liturgy-like. "Naked came I out of the womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Whence comest thou? From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it." In the prologue and epilogue, round numbers are used with a significance perhaps lost, but a repetition which by itself gives these chapters a folktale flavor sometimes associated with literary myth. This framework surrounds the Job poem proper, as it is called, an entirely different contradictory form, which also expresses the book's meaning. The poetic section is comprised largely of psalms of lamentation, a fixed form in the Old Testament. Form endows an utterance with force, whether approaching it as the writer, speaker, or reader. I learned this once when I was trying to write a poem about a loved one who had died. The initial writing brought some immediate release of feeling, but not with entire satisfaction. So I had to work it over several times over the ensuing weeks. It began as free verse, it evolved into blank verse, and it emerged as a fully rhymed sonnet. And only then did I feel that I'd said what I needed to say. Job's complaints are intrinsically beautiful, but they mean even more in the context of Hebrew poetic tradition. For instance, Job's initial reminiscence of the good old days before disaster struck was not just instinctive. The Old Testament lament often begins this way. It also contains an oath of clearance or self-justification, which is here the Catechism of Sins in chapter 31. Petitions to God are another standard element, as is the complaint proper or the direct statement of grievance with God, which forms the kernel of the psalm. Most of the complaints are a fairly fixed length, plus or minus six verses. We know this is not due to the discretion of the chapter and verse men, because unlike the chapter speeches, the endings are naturally divided by content. In addition to form, Job is replete with literary devices such as allegory. Take the address in, or the addressee in chapters 29 and 30, who must be more than an individual, perhaps a people, a nation, or a god. And it's full of imagery, especially the magnificent examples in the Lord's survey of his creation, which is foreshadowed by the friends and Job's allusions to nature. The friends talk about God in a very literary way, such as this passage: "He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who hath hardened himself against him and hath prospered?" The Psalm of Wisdom in chapter 28 is an entirely formal work, which solidly reminds the reader that this is more than a personal story. Many verses and chapters, again the Lord's survey, have that rhythm and richness which cry to be read aloud, and a good number of epigrams are still used in daily speech, or should be. These are some of them. "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. But now it toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Man that is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble." This sustained technique suggests sustained and intense feeling, and it cries for a reader of equal intensity. Who better fits this position than the mourner, whose role we all assume at one time or another? The book of Job is meant for the man or woman of sorrows, acquainted with grief and beset by life and society. Perhaps it is a work of the imagination, and the customs depicted here, the silent wake, the forum, the visitation by God, never really occurred. I want to believe that they did. I like to believe that it was inspired ritual, which impelled the friends to make the most comforting offering they could possibly have given, without themselves possessing the wisdom to know quite why they were doing it, nor how to go about it. But why should Job be so fortunate? Why shouldn't our state president in Riverton, or any other citizen of Riverton, be favored by a visit from his friends and then by the Lord? And why not revive the ancient custom of the grief ritual? Perhaps because we have the precedent of the book of Job, and that will have to suffice. Thank you.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to dialogue with the author of the paper and also with you, and I would like you all to feel free to interject at any time in my comments during them or after them to raise questions or make your own comments as you wish. My response to Ms. Cornwall's paper, which I found very stimulating, will be a modest one in comparison to all the work that she's done. What I did after I received a copy of her paper was to look through some of the recent literature on Job for points of contact with her ideas, and then I refreshed my own acquaintance with the text and spent some time meditating, incubating a bit on how her approach might advance my own understanding of a work which I think all of us will agree is very enigmatic. She comes at Job as a grief ritual, and it seems to me that this is a very fruitful approach. She, in her paper, has pretty well outlined for us the complex mixture of literary forms in the book. But despite that complexity of forms, Job does show the mark of one controlling hand with a variety of pre-existing materials and trying to pull them all together for his own purposes, his or her purposes. Uh, And at the same time, there do seem to be some interpolations into the text which don't fit very well and maybe represent attempts to either soften some of the violent statements of Job or reconstrue them in more acceptable terms. But all that taken into consideration, we probably would have to agree that Job is the work of one author who takes responsibility for it, despite the fact there might be some portions of it which don't quite fit, may have been added later, and so on. I think it's important to insist on the unity of the book, the basic overall unity, because if it's not a unified work, then all talk about it being a ritual is meaningless. It would then be just a collection of things. So we're dealing with a work which obviously is a masterpiece by a literary artist who knows what is to be done and carefully puts together a variety of literary forms that do it. I won't repeat the structure of the book. She's done that for us well enough to see the various parts of it. But I will emphasize, perhaps even more than she did, that there are at least 8 sections in the dialogue part, the poem, as she referred to it, which are laments. She has rightfully, I think, stressed the predominance of the lament form in Job. And they are to be found chiefly in Job's replies to his friends. In these laments, if anywhere, Ms. Cornwall's theme of grief is manifest. It seems plausible to me to emphasize, even perhaps more than she did, that Job is more than an emotional catharsis, though undoubtedly it serves that purpose. It is a way of getting out all the intense feelings that Job and the author of Job have about the human situation of suffering and tribulation. But it's more than that, and she did, I'm not saying she didn't point that out, but I think it needs to be emphasized, and I would like to dwell on it just a little bit more. What more is there in Job, as I see it? One thing more is that is the idea of spiritual growth. One of the recent commentators, R.A.F. McKenzie, points out that Job at the end of the book is a nobler and more admirable character than he was at the beginning. And indeed, at the same time, is more fully human at the end. In the prologue, at the beginning, we see a Job who does embody a certain ideal of human existence, a man who is endowed with the highest ethical and religious qualities and enjoys the perfection of external goods, for example, family, honor in society, and material riches. And post-exilic Jewish readers could easily identify with this ideal of the good life. But what is missing in this picture of Job at the beginning of the book is any sense of struggle and consequently any sense of achievement. Job is a man we can admire and marvel at, but we cannot seriously identify with him in the beginning. But in the dialogue section which follows the prologue, Job is brought down to our level and a transformation is begun. Affliction leads to temptation. His personal lament is voiced and then generalized beyond his own personal situation to include other sufferers and to raise the question of God's moral government of the whole world. The orthodox doctrine of rewards to the just and punishments to the wicked is called into question, and the nightmare of evil and of an evil God is faced. A desperate appeal to God for compassion lays to rest his friend's orthodox view of an apparent automatism in the deity. Job becomes like us in confronting the mystery of human experience as faced by all mankind. And then after Yahweh finally speaks to Job, he enters into a new relation with his Creator, made possible only by his experience of tribulation. He would not have been capable of it before. At the beginning of the book, Job is merely resigned and submissive. You recall, in chapter 1, he says, Yahweh gave, Yahweh took away, blessed be Yahweh's name. Resignation, submission. And he says to his wife in chapter 2, shall we accept good from God and not accept evil? Once again, resignation and submission. But at the end of the book, it's a different Job who cries, I had heard of you by hearsay, but now my own eye has seen you. So I recant and repent in dust and ashes. This is full acceptance of mystery confirmed by personal contact with the Almighty. So I think it's not just that Job is letting it all out. He's not just giving vent to his intense feelings, but he is also growing through this experience in his sense of mystery and in his experiential knowledge of God, no longer a knowledge that is a knowledge of by hearsay or traditional orthodox doctrine. So there's a different Job at the end than there was at the beginning. There's a sense of development of his character and personality. The other aspect of our paper that I would like to comment on is the very fruitful idea of ritual that she brought in. Time is too short to go into all the detail that would be desirable here. She does rightfully describe ritual as established codes of behavior regulating social or religious conduct. And that's an acceptable definition, I would think, of ritual. I'm sure she would allow for the interpretation that this ritual did not necessarily occur in a worship setting, say in the temple. It may have occurred in a less official kind of setting. I don't know, maybe she could comment on that in our discussion. A less formal kind of ritual, therefore, a ritual in the community, but not necessarily in the temple. Be that as it may, the notion of ritual does imply the concept of society accepting, or the community accepting, the person who goes through the ritual. Job, after all, and she brought this out nicely, Job, after all, does express a lot of things which are, we might say, not orthodox or heretical. His expression is blasphemous at times. He's not just going along with the accepted line. In fact, he criticizes his friends for that, for their hypocrisy, for their fawning flattery of God. Job says, none of that for me, and he just gives God what for, you know, why are you doing this? And are you less just than human beings? And really tears into him. Now, for a person to do that and not risk being expelled or excommunicated from the community requires the kind of community which says, it's okay. We recognize you feel this intensely about your suffering and about God, and it's all right for you to be angry. It's all right for you to express these tremendous feelings, and we're not going to kick you out. There's room for you. And that's what the ritual says. The ritual says, you can do this. And what it does for then is it makes the community a kind of symbol of the loving, compassionate God that Job finally comes to understand is God. So there is not only a psychological development in Job through the experience, but there is also a theological development in the concept of God, that God is not just a God who rewards the good and punishes the evil, but he is a God who more or less loves us warts and all, whether we're good or bad. He loves the good and the evil. God is compassionate, even though we can't understand that. There's a theological development, it would seem. And the point is that this occurs in the community. It's not just Job and the author of Job that has reached this theological understanding, but it is the community, perhaps, for which the author of Job is a mouthpiece that has reached that understanding. And in that sense, then, the community is, I would say, a kind of symbol for that compassionate God. It itself has sufficient compassion and love to embrace even a heretic and an outspoken guy like Job. Those are some personal reflections of my own, which I'm grateful to Ms. Cornwell for eliciting in me, making me meditate a little bit on a book which is certainly so enigmatic that there is no one answer. It challenges us, I think, to revise our own views and to see if there's room in our own thinking for a totally new look, or at least a radically new look at ideas that we have never questioned before. I think that's sufficient response on my part to perhaps provoke some conversation, and we'll give you the remainder of time to use it.
I just want to say thank you to both. I think I feel that I'm rarely treated to such richness of expression that we've heard today. We'll invite your participation. I'd like to give Becky a chance to respond to some of those comments. And also, you mentioned that you may have some reading of some selections, and I would be interested in that also.
I have no response. I think Brother Arway said is wonderful and pertinent and helps me think some more, and I appreciate them very much. It helps to have everyone's experience and everyone's viewpoints towards this book. Are there any comments? Hopefully no questions, but comments.
Yeah, I have several comments that are.
Would you like one of them? Do you have a comment on? Okay, please. Or both of you.
I think your remarks are well taken. I struggle myself with the concept of lament. And first of all, I think we should say that there is no one literary form in Job which characizes it. It is a multiplicity of literary forms, and lament is only one. And to say that the whole of Job is a lament would ignore five or six, or at least, or maybe even more, other types of literary forms there. So we can't reduce it to a lament. And you're quite right there, I think. Secondly, what do we mean by a lament? There's one commentator by the name of Gerstenberger, you're probably familiar with his work, who says Job isn't properly a lament. A lament is just an expression of sadness over something that we regret has happened. Job is more than that. It is a complaint, and that's what you want to stress. It's saying, I'm not just sad over what happened, but it shouldn't have happened, and you're responsible for it, God. So it's complaint to God, and I want you to do something about it. I want you to justify me, and I want you to take this away, and I want you to do something. I don't know what.
I want to take you to court.
Pardon me? Yeah, I want to take you to court. That's right. Yeah, take you to court. I want an umpire. I want a referee here. That sort of thing. And that's so pervasive through Job's that we can't deny it's there. And then at the end, it is pretty much of a mystery. I'm kind of glad that you called me on that thing about Job seeing God as love at the end. We think we know what we mean when we say God is love. But we're just substituting one mystery for another. Because love is as much of a mystery to us human beings as God is. So, you know, what is love? Is it love to just give people what they want? Is it love to only make people happy? Or is it love to push people to the extreme so that they can become everything they want? Is love the will to promote the other? Is that what real love is? However painful that may be. So when I said that Job at the end comes to see, to accept God as a God of compassion and love, I think that he doesn't really understand what that means yet, except in an experiential way. He doesn't have a, shall we say, an abstract or intellectual understanding of it. And she pointed that out, that he's not standing up there, sitting up there in the stands. He's down in the arena. But he's experiencing somehow, something happened in that theophany at the end. Something happened that gave him the experience of God that changed his concrete understanding of God as somehow compassion, even though I don't understand that compassion. And that's all I can say in answer to your comments, which I think are very well taken.
Thank you. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. Just one comment, and then I hope there'll be time for there are other questions.
There's another.
Okay. I think that what Brother Arway has said is true, that I would put it in experiential terms, too, that Job finally had to put his questioning and his lack of comprehension on the shelf. He just finally had to suspend it and say to God, I still have all these questions, but you are mightier than me, and I'm sorry I asked them. What he did is meet with his father, and any kind of reasoning and theology aside, he met with his father, and he found out that his father loved him and loved him enough to come down and talk to him and intervene in his case. And how could you fight with that? It's not intellectual. It's just, it happened.
Question?
Yeah, I understand there's a little bit of criticism.
Okay. We have just a little bit of time left, and Becky has asked her parents to read us some selections.
This is my mother, Gloria Foster, and she's going to read the prologue. And then my father, Glenn, is going to read the epilogue.
Am I allowed to make a comment here?
If it's not about me.
I think that the book of Job, since it's the only book in the Bible that is written for about an emotion, expresses very well how prevalent suffering is and how people do want to find answers to suffering and why it takes place. Becky hasn't told you, but we have 16 children, and I think we're kind of experts on suffering. Partly, they're very lovely, beautiful children, but children do not always follow or do the things that the parents consider is right. And I've in the years developed an entirely different attitude about raising children than I had in the beginning. I don't believe that it is our right to make children be what we want them to be. I believe that it's our obligation to let children be what they were when they were with God before they ever came to us. And that means that some of them are not going to agree with us in any of the things that we consider are important. They have their own lives to live and their own thing to be. And in Job, God says, tells Satan to do the thing. In other words, God doesn't do the suffering, but he does allow Satan to do it and to cause the suffering. And that's kind of a new attitude, too. And why would he allow Satan to cause suffering on the earth? I think that's one of the most important questions the book of Job asks. And the whole book, to me, seems to say, yes, you have a relationship with God. You must develop a relationship with God. But in the end, the problem is still up to you. What are you going to do about suffering? And how do you feel about it? And we have, and in the end, we have to work it out in our own way. And probably our relationship to God is the easiest way to work out suffering. And Becky asked me to read the first and second chapters of Job. There was a man in the land of Uz. His name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there was born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Whence comest thou?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it." And the Lord said unto Satan, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright, one that feareth God and escheweth evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house, and thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land? But put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, that he will curse thee to thy face." And the Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. So Satan had the Lord's permission to do this. And there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only have escaped alone to tell thee."
Thank you. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but we do need to end out of respect for the other sessions. Thank you for coming.